This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On Monday, architecture's highest honor, the Pritzker Prize, will be awarded to Zaha Hadid, who was born in Iraq in 1950 and now lives in London. She's the first woman to receive the Pritzker. She'll receive the medallion and $100,000 at the State Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. Although her work has been very influential, it's only recently that her designs have actually been made into buildings. Earlier this year, a profile of Hadid for the New York Times Magazine by Herbert Muschamp said, Hadid has been my personal Alfred Hitchcock movie for roughly 20 years. At times, the suspense has been unbearable. Would Hadid become a builder, or was she destined to remain celebrated as the designer of some of the greatest architecture never built? I talk with Hadid about her work. First of all, I want to congratulate you on a belated congratulations for winning the Pritzker Prize this year. Now let's get to your first American building, which is the Rosenthal Center for Contemporary Art in Cincinnati, which was completed in May of 2003. Is an art museum, a contemporary art museum, a good place to try adventurous design?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think it's always interesting to try this art on, not just as an experiment, but I think that it's suitable because, you know, it dealt in this case with the whole idea of movement and the urban context and the idea of civic space. And I think civic buildings, you know, lend themselves well to this kind of, research. But I think also one can equally say you can test that out on ideas of housing, which actually people have not touched on for a very long time. And how the public housing in a city can have an influence on the street. I mean, so I think that it's not because, this understanding it, because the ideas are kind of a bit crazy that it's suitable to only art institutions. I think they could be translated equally well for, you know, corporate work or for housing or parks or whatever.
Would you describe the Contemporary Art Museum in Cincinnati that you design?
Well, I mean, I think that what was interesting about it, it's a very tight site. So most of our work is sometimes horizontal, like it deals with layers and so on. So this is a stacked building, and the idea that you stretch the space of the museum vertically. The one thing which we try to do is to kind of really provide a very nice public space as an indoor room on the ground, which allows you people to only propel to the building, but also that the building connects to the street in a good way and therefore allows people to move through it in a seamless way. So it's like a series of rooms which are juxtaposed over each other and next to each other to allow these kind of spaces to be in concrete or in metal or in glass to allow light to come through the building, which is not, you don't see just kind of a solid object. And this idea of the transparency and the kind of geometry together provide a kind of an interesting interpretation of that space.
So you have all kinds of rooms of different shapes and sizes and with different types of light so that whatever piece they're showing at the moment, they could find a good setting for
it. Yeah, like you can have a kind of object in a very tall room or you can have a video installation in another kind of space and there's already provided. You don't have to kind of really invent partitions and stuff like that. But I mean, the museum is quite compact, and one thing which it has on the top level is an unmuseum, which is for children, where you can commission three-dimensional objects or spaces for like a children's museum, where you can touch and play with and stuff like that. And that was really also great fun.
Now, you've designed a science center for Wolfsburg, Germany, and that's nearing completion. I think when people think of science centers, they think of very futuristic design. Would you describe your design for this building?
Well, there's a kind of concrete building which is lifted off the ground. And I think the most interesting part about it, it has many kind of aspects. One thing which is very interesting about it is that if you imagine that the ground is empty, and then there are these very large cones in concrete which become the entrances, the theater, the restaurant. So you have an activity on the ground the whole, in the evening and in the day. And when it lifts up, it becomes one continuous space for the exhibit. So basically it's like a large table, let's say, with very big legs, and the legs they have program. And it makes them active the whole day and the whole evening. And then the top of the table with a roof is where the museum is.
So the legs are cone-shaped?
Their legs are kind of like cones, but they obviously don't have a point because they have a program. For example, one is a kiosk, one is a bookshop, one is a shop, one is a laboratory, one is a theater, one is restaurants and cafes. And the intention is that always, and mostly there are entrances. I mean, so you arrive there and you go up escalators or lift to the main plateau where all the exhibits are.
So it's like four buildings connected by the roof.
Yeah, like 7-8 cones, and they're all connected by a roof, and then there's another roof which covers the top of the table.
And what was the advantage of having them be separate but connected?
Well, first of all, the ground, I mean, we have, in terms of the urbanism, there was the city and there was the Volkswagen factory, which is on the other side, and there was a train station, and the idea was kind of to create paths through the building on the ground. So these paths, are not, the building doesn't block the path. So the idea that you can move from the station to the Autostadt, from the Autostadt to the city. And these paths also make the parameters of these cones. And then you can move up through the building. So the idea that the ground is really belongs to the city and therefore you can spill out from the restaurants and you can hang out there. And then you, as you move up, you go into the museum.
That sounds nice. If you're just joining us, my guest is the architect Zaha Hadid, and she won this year's Pritzker Prize, which is the top international prize for architecture. You grew up in Iraq. You were born in Baghdad in 1950. Now, I know you don't like to talk about the war or current politics, but I was hoping we could talk a little bit about some of the things that influenced your sensibility when you were growing up. First of all, as a woman, I'm wondering if you were, when you were a girl, if you were encouraged or discouraged about thinking in terms of a career, particularly such a male-dominated one as architecture.
No, I was always encouraged. I mean, not only by my parents, but by the school itself. I mean, I was talking yesterday that you know, all my contemporaries are, I don't know, a single one who's not a professional. And I mean, I think there's this view that because you are from the Arab world, you know, I think it's a kind of a not an accurate, let's say, perception. Particularly if Iraq, you know, where many women went into university and higher degrees and worked in variety of professional aspects of life. So I was always encouraged, let's say, both by my parents and by the school. And with the school, I went to a non-school, a Catholic non-school, although I'm a Muslim, but which was kind of a very tough school. And quite demanding academically, and I'm very grateful to them because I think that all that work in those years kind of made it possible for me to kind of really, let's say, do better.
Did your parents believe in modernity or tradition or some balance of the two?
I think they both believed in modernity, and particularly my father. I mean, both my parents believed in modernity. I think another thing which I think is in the Arab world, I mean, the whole connection between Islam and the Arab world is so integrated and so intertwined, and it doesn't really matter whether you're a Muslim or a Christian or Jewish. If you live in the Arab world, that the dominant force is culturally is kind of Islamic, although it's not religious necessarily all the time. And so my parents were always very liberal and open and not necessarily tradition in any way.
My guest is Zaha Hadid. On Monday, she'll receive the Pritzker Prize, architecture's top honor. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Zaha Hadid, the first woman to win the Pritzker Prize, architecture's top honor. The award ceremony is on Monday. Your father was one of the leaders of the Iraqi Democratic Party. How did your family's life change when Saddam Hussein came to power?
Well, I mean, I think that there were so many changes in Iraq. I mean, I think in the 63... And then in 68, I mean, my parents decided to stay in Baghdad and that was their choice. I mean, in a way, everybody's life was affected by these political changes, you know, but they decided that that's where they live and they're not going to leave, and I was abroad. So I really can't, you know, speculate how it changed because I wasn't witnessing what they were doing on a daily basis. But I think all our lives changed because we had so many coups in Iraq and it kind of constantly affected us.
Where were you going to school at the time? What country were you in?
I was in the late 60s. I was already out. I was in Beirut, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Or in London. In London.
Did your family stay in Iraq?
Oh, yeah, they did. I used to go back every year till the early 80s. I used to go back for holidays.
Why did you stop going in the early 80s?
Well, I think after the Iran war, it became very difficult to go back. And after the Gulf War, there was no mode of transportation to Baghdad. I mean, the airport was closed. You had to go via Jordan. You have to spend 16 hours on a car to go there, and I didn't go back.
It will seem odd, I think, to some of our listeners, that given everything Saddam Hussein has done, I'm going to ask you a question about his architecture. But, I mean, one of the things that Saddam did was commission monuments to himself. And some of them, from the pictures I've seen, just seem extraordinarily kitschy. I just wonder if you have any thoughts on the Saddam Hussein-era architecture, particularly his monuments to himself.
I haven't really seen them, so I can't, you know. I mean, I've seen them
in
photographs.
Right, you've seen them in photographs. Okay.
But, I mean, one can say the same thing about North Korea, I suppose, or, you know, parts of Germany. I mean, I don't think it, I mean, I don't believe in monuments personally. I don't think they add to the culture of a place. I mean, I think they're kind of delicate, these things, because they do represent a political view, and so whether one should do them or not is a bigger topic, let's say.
Saddam Hussein had the money to commission some spectacular buildings and pay various architects from around the world a lot of money to design them. And would you examine the politics of a country's leader before accepting a commission there? Or is that the wrong way to go about it, do you think?
I think it's very difficult to accept commissions from various countries, but I mean, one has to kind of then, one would say that nobody should work in so many other places in the planet. So,
right.
I think it depends on what the commission is. If somebody asked me to do housing there, I would, you know, for the indigenous population, and if that improves their life, then I have to think about it one way. If I'm asked to do something else, I have to think about it in a different way. I don't think it's going to blanket question answer situation.
Now, you said that most of the girls you grew up with in Iraq became professionals. They went into careers. That there was nothing that stood in your way of doing that growing up in Iraq.
No.
Once you became an architect, and you were working, I think, throughout your career, you've been working in London, did being a woman stand in your way as an architect?
It has. A lot.
How do you think?
Well, I think that there are more women architects now, so that kind of the whole, kind of idea that women can do it, has been, lifted, let's say, that prejudice. If I went to a meeting with an assistant of mine to a side, they would talk to him and not talk to me. If I were to meet kind of politicians. When I was in the Cardiff Opera House, I think the big problem was I was a woman and foreign and did this other stuff. So I think it does. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, there's a world which you, as a woman, no matter how successful you are, you can't enter into. You're not part of a network. You know, it takes you a long time, let's say, to come over these things. I mean, I never thought it would be a problem because, as I said, for a good reason or bad reason, I always thought, I should do well because the work is good. And that was the focus, is on the investment in the work and not into politicking for whatever other things. So I was quite surprised and shocked when all these, prejudices began to emerge. And it comes, I come across it less these days, but it's still there.
How did you manage to support yourself and your employees during the years that you were designing buildings that weren't actually getting built?
Well, we always had a project. We won many competitions, and so we had some income. I was teaching, that financed the office or give many lectures. But then, we were commissioned to do the housing in Berlin. We commissioned to do the project in Vitra for the fire station and another pavilion and many installations and exhibitions, and it was very tight and extremely difficult to survive, but I don't know how we managed. It was with tremendous difficulty. It was only juggling between teaching and lecturing and also some of these commissions. I mean, we're not really sitting in the office, knitting.
How do you like the commissioning system in architecture? It seems like, on the one hand, it must seem very fair on the one hand and very frustrating on the other, because you're always having to design buildings as if you were actually going to build them, but chances are you're not going to build them because it's a competition and only one company is going to win it.
Well, I think I personally like competitions because they do lift the standard. You know, also it's a public event, so people know about the project. They know about the site. They know about the story. It's not always fair when whom they choose, but let's say it's... Anyway, I've been grateful to the system, because if it wasn't for competition, I would not have any work, very little, you know. It was only because in the last 5 years, I won quite a few. And my first project, The Peak, which was I won in 83, was the one which propelled me into the scene, let's say. It was another competition, which was a very big competition. Now these competitions are much smaller and more invited and, let's say, less open. But I still believe in a system, you know. It's not always fair, but I still think it's... I haven't had the privilege of actually being commissioned directly to do projects so many. I'm more so now, but it's not been so easy.
Now, I want to ask you a question about design of a different sort, and this is clothing design. People who write about you always point out that you wear Issey Miyake clothes, and I'm wondering how important the design of clothes is to you as somebody who, is so caught up in designing architecture.
Well, you know, I think it's fun to dress. You know, when I was in school in London, I used to kind of wrap myself in, you know, fabrics and funny stuff like that. I think it's a balance of not being a fashion victim, but to wear something which, you know, you feel comfortable in and you enjoy wearing. You know, I think it's really the bottom line. It's not about making some sort of statement about, you know, that you're wearing cheap or expensive clothes or a particular thing because it's fashionable. I think it's important to actually be able to express yourself the way you dress. And this might be something you design or someone else has designed. And Issey Miyake is particularly, I have a tremendous respect for him. And Yoji, actually, the Japanese are particularly good. And they're easy to travel with. They're very light. They can kind of compact. They crush into a small, you crumble them into a small corner of a suitcase. You can carry lots of things with you when you're traveling. When you're in your hotel, you don't have to iron them. They're perfect when you open them. So there's all these things which have to do with, on one hand, practical issues, on the other hand, you know, fun issues. You can wear them upside down, side, you know, back to front. You have more than one up and one go. So it's kind of fun.
Well, I want to congratulate you again on winning the Pritzker Prize, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Architect Zaha Hadid. She'll receive the Pritzker Prize at a ceremony on Monday. You can see photos of her work at the website npr.org.